Once again, it is I, Brad Friedman, happy to spend the next 3 hours with you truth seekers out there from coast to coast and around the globe here on the Mike Malloy program, sitting in one last day for Mike. He will be back along with Kathy on Monday in fine fettle, and I have a feeling he'll be in a fighting mood for a change. So you can look forward to that, and if you can put up for me with just a few more hours, I'd be delighted. I'll try to make it worth your while. We've got a big show coming up tonight. It is, as you know, the eighth anniversary of 9/11, when 2,998 folks were killed in an attack in New York City, in Washington, D.C., and somewhere in a field in Pennsylvania. Since then, 5,167 U.S. troops have been killed in response in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we lost just under 3,000 on September 11th, and we've lost a couple hundred over 5,000 since then. Of course, those numbers, as I wrote today, do not reflect the those folks who were injured in the events mentioned, nor the uncountable lives lost of those who responded following the 9/11 disaster. Doesn't count the private contractors killed abroad in our multiple wars, our multiple continuing wars, nor the journalists who covered them, nor the hundreds of thousands of non-U.S. citizens in foreign countries who similarly became victims in the horrific events of the months and years which followed that fateful day. I vowed at the Brad blog today that we will remember them not just today, but every day, and in their memories, I vow, never to live in fear. So tonight we will be fearless. We will, to quote Glenn Beck quoting Tom Jefferson, we will question with boldness as we talk about 9/11 from a bunch of different angles. Get your thoughts on it. You can give us a call tonight at 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. Don't use Mike Malloy's normal number. Use that one, 877-520-1150. We'd love to hear from you. I'm going to have John Farmer with us very momentarily. John Farmer was the senior counsel, one of the senior counsels to the 9/11 Commission. He's got a new book out in which he says, well, everything that, not everything, but a great deal of what the government and military officials told Congress and the 9/11 Commission and the media and the public was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. Really? That's a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. So we are going to be asking him many questions about that. If you'd like to ask a question to a senior counsel on the 9/11 Commission, well, now is your opportunity. Also going to take the opportunity to ask him some questions that are apparently not allowed to be asked, at least if you want to serve in the Barack Obama administration. Some questions that were on a 9/11 truth statement that was signed by 50 family members and that Glenn Beck apparently found quite objectionable. So we're going to try to ask him about some of those questions as well, because I think this country needs to have discussion. I think questions need to be asked. I think we need to investigate and follow those investigations wherever they may lead. I'll be probably giving you some of my own feelings tonight about 9/11 and about the conspiracy theories surrounding it, and I don't say that with any disdain. I'll try to talk about where I stand on that, and we'll try to get some real answers for a change from the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission and from folks out there from a lot of different angles. So let me get straight to Mr. Farmer here. John Farmer joins us. He is, as I said, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. Oh, before I do that, Bradblog.com has our chat room open tonight. Agent 99 will be manning that, hosting that, hostessing that all night. So if you'd like to stop by over there and take part in the rather lively discussion try to get my attention with some questions there, I'll do my best to keep an eye on that chat room. All right, back to business here. John Farmer is a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. He served as the Attorney General of New Jersey, Chief Counsel to Governor Christine Todd Whitman. He's now the Dean of Rutgers University Law School, and he joins us here tonight, very happily so. He is the author of the new book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. John Farmer, welcome to the Mike Malloy Program.
Well, thanks, Brad. Appreciate it.
Really,
thanks for having me.
Sure. Really glad to have you here, particularly on today of all days. All right. In your book and in the publicity for the book, you note that what government and military officials told Congress, the 9/11 Commission on which you served, the media and the public, was, quote, almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. That's some pretty heady allegations there. And before we find out what was inexplicably untrue, it occurs to me, with a claim like that from a senior counsel on the 9/11 Commission, you must be barraged with media requests. 60 Minutes, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. Is that true? Are the media paying attention to such an extraordinary claim as you're making here?
It's been a busy week, let me put it that way.
has it been as much as you would have expected?
Yeah.
Good.
I think I've done probably 30 plus interviews this week, so
good.
There has been interest in the book, and I hope the book makes a contribution to settling a lot of the speculation that's occurred out there.
Fair enough. All right, so let's jump into some of the key points, and you detail some of them. I know you've got what you describe as whiskey tango foxtrot moments, in other words, known as WTF moments. I think a lot of people listening will understand what that means. But what are the key points here which you found in your investigation, really after the 9/11 Commission put out its report, that what was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue?
Well, I should point out that my function with the 9/11 Commission was to lead a team to put together an account of the nation's reaction to the attacks. In other words, reconstruct the events of the day of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And there are obviously many components to that, from what the president was doing, the vice president, to what the Pentagon was doing, to what the firefighters and police in New York were doing, to what was happening virtually all over the country. So a very daunting task when you had basically a year and a half to put it together. So going into it, I really thought that the air defense side of that story would be the easiest part to put together, simply because the story had been told so many times in so many different forums. There had been testimony before Congress. There had been major network news specials dedicated strictly to the air defense story. There had even been an early commission hearing dedicated to that subject. So the story was out there and it had been told numerous times. So I actually started writing an account of the day of, based strictly on the public sources, figuring that, well, we'll get hold of the primary sources and we can simply validate what's already been told.
Mm-hmm.
But to my disappointment, to put it mildly, when we started getting access to the primary sources, which ultimately took a subpoena to the FAA and to the Department of Defense, we couldn't verify the public account that had been given. And to summarize what that account was, it basically overstated the efficacy and the efficiency of the government's response. And specifically, what we had been told after 9/11 was that by the time of the third flight, American 77, which ultimately hit the Pentagon, the national command structure had recovered from the shock of the two flights that hit the World Trade Center and had reestablished itself, essentially, and had scrambled planes from Langley Air Force Base to protect the Capitol. And those planes narrowly missed intercepting American 77, but were certainly in position by the time of United 93 hijacking. And when that turned toward Washington, they were certainly in position that they could have taken the plane out if they had to as it approached Washington. And what we found happened, in fact, when we went through the records and through the tapes and the different logs that were kept, they told a very consistent story, which was that, in fact, the military had had basically a minute's notice that American 77 was missing with no location given, and they had had actually no notice of 93 until 4 minutes after the plane crashed, so they never were able to even locate that flight on radar. The planes were scrambled from Langley, but it was not in response to either of the last two flights. It was in response to a mistaken report that had come across the radio that the first flight, American 11, had actually not hit the Trade Center at all, but was still airborne heading south for Washington. So in other words, to finish the story, the authorization to intercept and potentially shoot down planes came from the National Command Structure, from the President and Vice President, about 30 minutes after United 93 had already crashed. So that particular authorization was never passed to the pilots because at that point there was no target.
Interesting. So, hold the thought there, John. Yeah. I'm speaking with John Farmer, Senior Counsel to the 9/11 Commission, author of the new book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. We're going to take your calls at 877-520-1150. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, in for Mike Malloy. A whole lot more right after this. Stay with us. For John Farmer, my guest, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, author of The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. This book is just out, released within the last week or two. And we're going to dig in, take as many of your calls and questions as we can. I've got a lot of my own, of course, 877-520-1150. And you can participate over at the chat room at bradblog.com. All right. Let me get Jen. There we go. Got Mr. Farmer back on here. John, you were speaking before the break about some of the things that you were told and the public was told, the commission was told, that were, quote, almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. You referred to the fact that the claim that they could have taken out Flight 93 if they had wanted to, that they had it within their sights and so on and so forth. Why do you suspect some of these stories would have been told that were so wildly inaccurate as you describe them?
I think there was an effort to make the government look, you know, better than it was that day, and to make the national command structure seem like it was more in control than it really was in those critical moments. And I think in doing that, one of the unfortunate byproducts was that they obscured some of the really important lessons from that morning, among which are, you know, how critical decisions are actually made in a cataclysmic situation like that, and the essential estrangement of the top levels from the people on the ground who actually had to improvise the national defense was important, because we saw it replicated a few years later in Hurricane Katrina. Completely different kind of event, in fact not a surprise at all, something that had been planned for years, but when it actually hit, the same kind of dynamic occurred where people on the ground in New Orleans were waiting for word from the upper levels of government, and there was a disconnect in communications and difficulty communicating, and they didn't have the authority to make critical decisions. And I think one of the things that comes out of this study that I think is important is the imperative that we actually plan to deal with these crises the way they're actually experienced, as opposed to according to some, you know, organization chart.
Right, and we seem to have we constructed an organizational chart after 9/11 in response to 9/11, and then, as you point out in the book, it doesn't seem that we paid much attention to it when it came to Katrina. So it's unclear that we even learned anything from 9/11, frankly. And I wonder the effectiveness of the commission. You guys did not have subpoena power early on. And how badly do you think that ended up crippling the final report that was released by the 9/11 Commission?
Well, let me just say that I think the report is extremely accurate and sets forth the facts of 9/11. And actually, we did point out in the report the discrepancies between between the accounts that were given and what we actually found. But what's different is, you know, in this account is, I think, by telling it structurally differently. In other words, in the Commission report, we told it flight by flight, as much for the sake of clarity as anything else, just so you could understand with each flight what happened.
Right.
That's not the way it was lived, though, by the people who had to respond, and that's what this book does. It tells the story almost from their perspective, when everything's flying at them at once. And I think the value of that is that you can see that, taken as a whole, you can see that the real enemy of preparedness is bureaucracy, and that's a tough nut to crack, but I think it's the one we have to if we're going to be better in the future.
And you've broken that all down in a timeline in the back of the book, painstaking details based on the radio transmissions and so forth that did exist, even though they originally said they didn't. We're going to talk much more about that, take your calls, and I'm going to ask a few of Glenn Beck's questions to John Farmer, author of Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack. I'm Brad, sitting in for Mike. We're back with a whole lot more. Stick with us right after this. To the Mike Malloy program, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, your friendly citizen investigative journalist, blogger, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around good guy, drafted into duty here to be the media all week. This week for Mike, while they're taking a break, he will be back Monday. We're speaking with John Farmer, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. He served as the Attorney General of New Jersey for a while, and he's got a new book out called The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11, in which he says that the official story given to Congress and the Commission and the media and the public was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. We're going to take your calls in a moment. The board is lighting up at 877-520-1150. Let's see. All right, got him back. All right, I have a number of questions for you, John.
Okay.
Let me start here. Let's get right to the accountability thing. Given what the commission was told that appeared to be untrue, and one of them that you you write in your book about that you had direct access to was the NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector. You were told there were not tapes of radio transmissions, and in fact, there were tapes of radio transmissions, as you later learned. Given the various lies that were given for whatever reason, how can it be, in your opinion, that when George Bush and Dick Cheney were interviewed themselves about their response, about their readiness, their preparation, and anything else, that they were allowed to testify together, not recorded? Now, you're the former Attorney General of New Jersey. Can you explain to me how it is that you allow two folks involved in an investigation to be interviewed together like that?
Well, that that was a decision that was reached in negotiation with the White House, a negotiation I was not personally involved with, so I can't really relate the details of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a negotiated agreement with the president and vice president, and we it was, you know, detailed notes were taken. I was not part of that interview, so I can't really comment on the specifics of it. But
well, as an attorney general, how do you feel about it? You didn't take part in the negotiations, I understand, but in an investigation, how do you feel about, oh, two people involved in that investigation would like to speak together and would not like to have any of it recorded?
Well, it depends on the. It really depends on the context. I mean, you know, in certain types of criminal investigations, you wouldn't want to have that happen. But I've been involved in corporate internal investigations where it's actually easier to get to the truth doing it that way because they play one off against the other. So, you know, it really depends on the context.
And so you have no problem with that in general?
No, in general, I don't. It really depends on the individual circumstances. It could be problematic, and it might not be. And I think we did a good job of pointing out areas in which, you know, we took issue with the version of events that they recounted.
Do you think there was proper accountability brought to the folks who did drop the ball before 9/11?
Well, you know, I think, again, if you read the book as a whole, I think if there's a villain in the book, other than Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, who are, we can never forget, are the principal villains, but it's bureaucracy itself. And I don't think enough has been done to sort of reinvent government. That was the term used in the 90s. And there was a recognition that, you know, in the post-Cold War period, threats were likely to arise asymmetrically, and there was a need to reconfigure government. And there were efforts being made, but they didn't go far enough, and they were not effective. And so the answer to your question, in my view, is I think a lot more needs to be done, and it has to be at a very, very fundamental level, because, you know, bureaucracy is the enemy of preparedness, and that's really, if I'm going to state one conclusion from the book, that's what it is.
So it was, as you see it, it was bureaucracy, incompetence, perhaps, not necessarily malfeasance or misfeasance by these folks?
Well, you know, if you had, for example, if you had one agency that was you know, really responsible for the whole thing and it totally screwed up and you know, I could see then wanting to, you know, to have the let the heads roll kind of mentality. But when you see, as I detail in the book, an agency after agency, department head after department head, of varying degrees of abilities and across departments, across crises, because you had the same thing in Katrina, different departments, and you realize that they all have one thing in common, and that is an inability to cope with this creature that we've, you know, that we come to call bureaucracy. And when you have failures on that scale, I don't think it really benefits anybody to start scapegoating people, because I think that actually lets bureaucracy off the hook.
Well, there's a difference between scapegoating and accountability. I mean, when people are warned time and again, as we understand that the Bush administration was warned, do you feel that they, your feeling is they didn't respond to those warnings from Richard Clark and so forth simply because, oh, it's such a big bureaucracy out there?
I think you have to go before that. You can go by the time President Bush took office. Remember that the Al-Qaeda conspirators had essentially run the gauntlet of our trillion-dollar early warning system. They had managed throughout the 90s to elude detection by the NSA, by the CIA, and one of the hundreds of military bases that we have stationed around the world to provide early warning. They had managed to get through customs. They had managed to get into the country.
Well, there was a lot of things.
So that by the time the summer of 2001 came along, they had basically run the gauntlet through every better funded department than FAA and NORAD. And at the end of the day, we had probably two of the least well funded organizations in the government that ended up having to fight the war that day.
But at the top of the government, one of the best funded agencies in the government, the White House, there was very clear warnings. Was there not?
Listen, there's no question about it. And look, I think the failures are so pervasive and so widespread. You know, they had after the millennium, there was an after-action report done that basically pointed out that our preparations domestically for a terrorist event were very lax. And that report was out there. And in fact, it's that report that that Sandy Berger, the former National Security Advisor to President Clinton, actually took copies of and stole from the National Archives before he was scheduled to testify before the commission, hid them in a construction site, and then destroyed them.
And was there accountability for that?
Well, he pled to a misdemeanor.
Okay. And was there accountability anywhere else in the government that you see?
Well, there was, as a consequence of our referral of the credibility story to the Inspectors General of Department of Defense and Department of Transportation, there was a Department of Transportation employee disciplined as a result of failing to be forthcoming with us.
A Department of Transportation employee?
Yeah, well, someone from the FAA, essentially.
Okay, but nobody from the, actually from the Bush administration whose job it was to protect against this sort of thing?
Well, if there was, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah. Okay. And, well, now let me get to some of these questions that Glenn Beck, you may have heard, was able to railroad this guy, Van Jones, the president's green jobs advisor, out of a job because he signed on to a statement along with 50 family members of 9/11 victims asking certain questions. And he highlighted a number of those questions. And John Farmer, I'm sorry to make you the victim somewhat here of Glenn Beck, but he highlighted about four of these 12 questions that all seemed reasonable to me. And I'll note that I don't have a dog in this hunt. I just want to know what the hell happened. So I'd like to ask you the four questions that he found so outrageous. And you may or may not be able to answer them. I don't know. But I'm going to go ahead and toss them out here, John.
Okay.
The first one, I'll go through in order. Why did the Secret Service allow Bush to complete his elementary school visit apparently unconcerned about his safety or that of the school children?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, why President Bush continued to sit in the classroom after he was advised that the nation was under attack. I think that, you know, this is just my opinion, but I think he was trying to, A, assimilate the information. It was kind of startling. And at the same time, because he knew he was being filmed, I think he was trying to project an image of calm, that he was, you know, not going to be rattled by this, and he was going to leave at an appropriate time, and he made that judgment.
And are you offended that I ask you that question?
No.
Thank you. All right, let me ask a few more that Glenn Beck highlighted that he found so unbelievable that he couldn't imagine how Van Jones would even be allowed near the president for having signed on to some of these questions. All right, how could Flight 77, which reportedly hit the Pentagon, have flown back towards Washington, D.C. for 40 minutes without being detected by the FAA's radar or even superior radar possessed by the U.S. military?
Well, it's not clear that the military possessed superior radar for as the first answer to that, but the second answer is, you know, it did appear there was an area in the country where there was a gap in radar coverage in the mountains, and so it was off radar for a while, and it did appear as a primary radar track, not a beacon signal, which would clearly have indicated which flight it was. But it was, you know, but you have to understand that in the radar picture with primary tracks, it's really an ocean of primary tracks, and unless you know exactly what you're looking for, it's hard to pick it out. And you know, we
for 40 minutes though, it could disappear like that.
Well,
behind,
you know,
a mountain?
They were the controllers were actually, once it vanished from radar, they were, and it had been heading west. The controllers in Cleveland were actually looking west for it and couldn't find it. And ultimately, they started looking back the other way, but they simply didn't pick it up.
Okay, and you're not offended by that question, are you,
no,
John?
Not
okay,
at all.
Thank you. Let me get one more here before we got to go to a break. Then we'll have some more Beck questions and your calls. And John, you're invited to stay around as long as you like tonight, because there's a lot of folks who want to ask you a lot of questions.
Well, actually, I have a 10 o'clock appointment.
Damn
so
it. All right.
10
well,
o'clock in the east, so I've got another 15 minutes, then I got to go.
Then we're going to move quick here. How
okay.
were the FBI and CIA able to release the names and photos of the alleged hijackers within hours, as well as to visit houses, restaurants, and flight schools they were known to frequent?
Well, it's a complicated story, but the bureau at least, and to a lesser extent the CIA, was actually looking for several of these people in the days and weeks leading up to 9/11, and you know, hadn't located them. But when they saw the passenger manifests from the flights, it wasn't hard to figure out who was who. You know, this is one of those areas where, you know, it's when you look at it from the outside, well, how could they have been looking for them and not found them? But they didn't, and that's one of the tragedies of 9/11, and that's one of the areas in which the barriers for information sharing between the two agencies really prevented them from finding them.
I'm glad to get your answer to that on record, and once again, you're not offended by that question, right?
No,
okay, thank you. We're going to speak more with John Farmer, senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission and author of the new book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. One more question that Glenn Beck found so offensive, and I'm going to try to get as many of your calls in as I can in the remaining time we have left with Mr. Farmer. You're listening to the Mike Malloy Program. Brad Friedman in for Mike, and we're going to be with you all night long. Stick with us. To the Mike Malloy Program, Brad Friedman of bradblog.com in for Mike on the 8th anniversary of 9/11. Mike and Kathy will be back next Monday. We're speaking with John Farmer, the author of The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. John was a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, and he notes that so much of what the public and the media and the commission were told was, quote, almost entirely and inexplicably untrue, and we're trying to unwind which points were inexplicably untrue. To that end, I want to get right to the phones as quickly as I can, but I got one more question from Glenn Beck, who was so offended by these questions when Van Jones signed on to a statement essentially asking for a new investigation by 50 family members or so. That last question, John, try to do it quick here. Why did the Bush administration cover up the fact that the head of the Pakistani intelligence agency was in Washington the week of 9/11 and reportedly had $100,000 wired to Mohammed Atta, considered the ringleader of the hijackers?
I don't know whether that's true. I can't comment on that. If that's, you know, I don't know.
Have you heard that allegation before?
No, I haven't.
And do you think, if it is true, is it an appropriate question to ask and to get an answer to from someone?
If it's true, absolutely.
Okay, fair enough. All right, Jeannie Dean in the chat room says she's concerned about the NORAD failures and the contradictions in the NORAD-related testimony. I know that was your beat on the commission.
Yep.
Here. Why was it completely overlooked by the commission? She feels that the NORAD failures were overlooked when it was the most damning evidence to date that there is something that demands further investigation here. The family members requested a follow-up investigation, but what happened there?
Well, the short answer is that it wasn't the failures weren't ignored. They were actually highlighted in chapter one of the report. Originally, that chapter was supposed to be chapter nine. It was supposed to come, you know, sort of in sequence. But the commissioners decided to move it up to the front because we had discovered these discrepancies, and so they were actually highlighted in the report.
And are you satisfied finally with the answers to those discrepancies and why? Why they existed, why NORAD did fail on that day?
Well, you know, I think you have to distinguish between what they actually did that day and what they and what the government told people they did, because you know, what the book does at a level of detail that the commission couldn't, because the material was still classified at the time that the commission report came out, and it's since been declassified. But it lays out exactly, you know, who said what to whom and how the reaction took place, and you basically are left with a lot of empathy for these folks in NORAD, who had to react on the fly to a situation that they were not really trained to react to.
Okay, let me get to Keith here in Norwalk, California. Keith, as quickly as you can ask your question, because we're gonna have to lose Mr. Farmer at the top of the hour. Keith.
No problem. As far as the Keenzilla account cover-up that you're involved in goes, I would like to ask you, how were the FBI able to confiscate the Citgo gas station's tape so quickly, and where are those photos? I'd like to see them.
Thanks, Keith. And did you get to look at those tapes from the Pentagon, John?
Yes, we did, and I know there's been a lot of speculation about whether a plane actually hit the Pentagon. I can assure you that it did, and they actually were able to reconstruct large components of the plane, and actually someone who was a member of my team was a naval intelligence officer in the Pentagon that morning, was severely burned, and in fact everybody in his unit was killed and had a permanent lung damage from inhaling jet fuel. He has no doubt that a plane hit the Pentagon.
But why was there no debris field, really, out there in Pennsylvania, and why have no pieces of the plane showed up from the Pentagon crash?
Well, pieces of the plane do exist in the Pentagon crash, and I would take issue with the Pennsylvania remark, too. I mean, I think the Pennsylvania situation is accounted for by the fact that the angle at which the plane hit the ground was almost directly perpendicular, and I think that accounted for how deep the crater was. And then the other question to ask yourself with respect to this is, well, if American 77 didn't hit the Pentagon, what happened to American 77? And what about the passengers who were calling from the plane saying they were coming back to Washington?
Okay, and just to be clear, because we're hitting the clock here, John,
yeah.
you have seen tapes of a plane hitting the Pentagon?
I haven't seen tapes, pictures of a plane actually hitting the Pentagon, but there were eyewitness accounts. And as I said, there are pictures of the plane in the vicinity.
John, and I got to get out. John, yeah. Farmer, author of Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. I do thank you for your time tonight, John. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Program Brad Friedman of bradblog.com in for Mike Malloy here on the 8th anniversary of 9/11. Interesting conversation with John Farmer, the senior counsel for the 9/11 commission, author of the new book The Ground Truth. So many questions certainly that I would have liked to have asked him. I know you would have liked to ask him, because the phones are still lit up, and I'm gonna try to run through those calls, because you know, asking questions is important. Fact of the matter is that while 2,998 folks died on 9/11, 5,167 U.S. troops have been killed in response to that since. And that does not, of course, count the hundreds of thousands who have been killed in other countries. Perhaps more than a million, according to Johns Hopkins University. That does not count the numbers of those who have been injured for life, the price that we continue to pay. New York Post reported recently that the toll's still climbing for the folks, the first recovery folks, first response folks at the World Trade Center, that more than 800 World Trade Center rescue and recovery workers have died since 9/11, and cancer has killed at least 270 of those heroes, the new data shows. The figure also shows that 33 World Trade Center responders committed suicide. State researchers have tallied 817 deaths of workers and volunteers who toiled at the toxic Ground Zero site, or the Fresh Kills landfill, where the rubble was sifted. The toll goes on and on. The price continues to be paid for whatever the hell happened there. Asking questions about what happened there is our right, is our duty. And I'll tell you, I am sick and damn tired of hearing right-wingers talking about the freedoms of this country. And they won't allow the freedoms to ask questions about what the hell happened. I'm sick and tired of folks like Glenn Beck and Fox News telling us that we can't ask questions. That if you dare to ask a damn question about what happened on 9/11, you have no business working in the Obama administration, which is exactly what that disgrace of a human being Glenn Beck did to Van Jones, Obama's green jobs advisor, because he had the temerity to ask the questions that I have just asked, at least a few of them, to the senior counsel on the 9/11 commission. He said he was not offended by them, and he spoke to them. He answered them. I didn't have time to do follow-ups, and frankly, I'm not skilled enough to do follow-ups on all of the detailed points of what happened on 9/11. But I wanted to get the answers on record, and I wanted to, you know, demonstrate that we can talk in this country. We can debate. We can discuss. We can ask uncomfortable questions. The exact same thing that Glenn Beck lied to his viewers and told them that he wanted to do. Told them that he believed in. Clearly, he doesn't believe in asking questions. Clearly, he doesn't believe in freedom. He believes only in fear. Speaking of fear, Rush Limbaugh lives in fear. Lives in fear that you'll notice what a coward he is. He's very disappointed today because you are all not out there cowering in fear of the boogeyman who's coming to get you. And he had to, the twists and turns and the tortured reason that he had to use today to find some reason to attack Barack Obama on 9/11 of all days. We're going to play some of that audio in a bit. This dude is twisted, pathetic, small, a disgrace. And the worst of it is, he's coming to you in every town and city in this country, across the airwaves, across hundreds and hundreds of stations, on the public airwaves, on your airwaves. He is sucking off the government teat so that he could lie to you. Heck of a job, Rush. Heck of a job, America. Corporate America. And those of us who allow it to continue. I won't. Not if I have anything to say about it. And no, I won't live in fear. Never. We're going to take your calls, 877-520-1150. We got a lot to talk about. I know a lot of you folks on the line had questions for John Farmer. He was not able to stay around. Believe me, I wanted him to, because I wanted him to get your questions. But in lieu of him being here, and in hopes that it ticks off Glenn Beck, let's try to run through your thoughts. At least let's get them out on the air. And you can ask questions. You can hold me accountable. You can hold anybody accountable. That's what freedom is about. That's what America is about. That's what we claim to be about. You know that whole home of the brave thing? Yeah, well, a lot of these guys don't actually mean it. All right, let's... Let's go to Amira in Montclair, New Jersey. Welcome to
I'm in Montclair, California.
Oh, Montclair, California. I am so firing my screener after this show.
Thank you so much, Brad. You have echoed my sentiments exactly. I could not have put it better. Let me just scatter out a few little thoughts, and I have a couple questions for you that I would have liked to have asked Mr. Farmer. I do think that the introduction to his book sounds like a jacket blurb to get people to buy the book, because all he did was defend the commission. There wasn't anything that he said that was untrue. at least according to the brief amount of time that you had with him.
Yeah.
Number one is that Phil Zelikow, who is hardly a nonpartisan, was in directly in charge of that entire commission report. He was responsible for the outcome of it. I understand that when the people went in to look at the documents, they were not allowed to either make copies or even take notes out of the White House.
Yeah, it was appalling. And the fact that a guy like Zelikow would be the executive director there, I did have some questions because when I announced that John Farmer was coming on, I got some from some real 9/11 folks who have investigated this stuff. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to ask those questions. But if he was here, what is your question? And you're putting it out on the air. What would you want to know?
Okay, now here, just I'm going to
on the public airwaves, your airwaves, Amira.
Right, I'm going to take a couple of things. Number one, I would like to have asked him why did Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton tell the public after the Nine Commission report was published that the Pentagon had lied to them? Number two, why is it that six of those nine hijackers are still alive? One is a pilot in Saudi Arabia. This has been documented, and it's in chain of command by Seymour Hirsch. And my last question.
You're saying Seymour Hirsch has alleged that six of the nine hijackers,
the 19 hijackers
are still alive?
Chain of command, and one is a Saudi pilot. He was a pilot in Saudi Arabia at the time of the 9/11 attacks. He is still there.
Okay.
Okay, and the third one was he completely flubbed the question by the previous caller about the 96 tapes that after a couple of hours after the so-called plane crashed and evaporated into the Pentagon, like the one that evaporated in Pennsylvania, which I find very hard to believe. Nevertheless, the FBI picked up 96 security tapes in the vicinity from the gas station, the hotels, and all in the area. And you, the questioner asked, have you seen the tapes? He said, yes. Is there evidence that a plane crashed?
Well,
he said,
he said, hang on, Amir, hang on. To be fair, he said he saw photos, he says, and I don't know if he says he saw still photos and that there was a personal eyewitness accounts.
And then he said seen a plane in those photos in the vicinity. So when he said, yes, there was evidence of a plane into the Pentagon, he waffled, he took that back, and he, answer was very poor.
Thanks for your thoughts, Amira. Do appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Let me get to John in North Hollywood. Hey, John, welcome to the Mike Molloy program.
Well, you know, I think that last caller did have ample reason to doubt this farmer. I think he's sowing bad seed in this ground here, so to speak.
Okay.
Two reasons I'd like to give. I was going to talk about something else, but I listened to this guy talk.
Well, let's go to what you wanted to originally talk about, John, because I got a lot of folks I got to get to. I'm sorry.
He engaged in incompetence theories, in an incompetence theory of the
bureaucracy,
the defense bureaucracy to try to get him off the hook.
Okay.
You know, you can't prove incompetence without proving intent, and that intent's a much more difficult burden of proof than complicity.
Okay.
In conspiracy. But he also said that the plane crashed at perpendicular into the Pentagon.
That's what he said.
Oh yeah. I don't buy that.
Okay.
Okay, because if it were perpendicular, there are two pieces. There wouldn't be a perfect hole in the side of the building. There'd be a great big hole in the ground.
Okay.
And also the parking camera on CNN that showed a little flying vehicle at round.
All right, John, I gotta move.
Level.
Gotta get to a break here, John.
That was not going perpendicular.
All right, I think he meant parallel down, sort of straight into the side. That was my understanding of it. We'll take more of your calls. We'll talk about that small, small, sad, sad man, Rush Limbaugh, and how the way he was spending 9/11. A whole lot more ahead. Brad Friedman in for Molloy. I took too long. All right. Well, we'll come back and we'll take these calls. I'm just a blogger. I don't know how this radio stuff works. Okay. Oh, let me mention, by the way, the space shuttle has landed safely minutes before airtime. We heard what we thought for a second could have been an earthquake or something, like a boom, boom. Turns out that was the sonic boom from the space shuttle, from the nose and from the tail, because it landed out here at Edwards Air Force Base quite safely. That's one good story we can report tonight. We got a whole lot more straight ahead, which may not be quite as good, quite as happy, but hey, that's what the public airwaves are for. Use them or lose them. Brad Friedman, in for Malloy. And I won't back down. Well, I know what's right. I got... to the Malloy program. Brad in for Malloy. Taking your calls at 877-520-1150 on this, the 8th anniversary of 9/11. You know it's the 8th anniversary because you can look at that rebuilt tower in New York City. Our pride, our joy. Oh, wait, that hasn't... No, it's still a hole in the ground? Okay. Clarify one point here. Phil in the bradblog.com chat room clarifies that John Farmer actually had said that the plane in Pennsylvania came in perpendicular, and that was one of the reasons why there was no debris field. Is that a legitimate answer? I don't know. I don't, you know, I'm not an expert in this stuff, but I do think asking these questions is important. Getting John Farmer's answers on the record as a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, getting those on the record so the discussion can continue, so that we can either get at the bottom of what happened or put an end to the questions. I'm not even going to call them conspiracy theories. I'm going to say to the questions. And if we can't talk in America, if we can't ask questions, if we're going to play, McCarthy-esque tactics on folks who joined the Obama administration because they dared ask these questions, oh, I'm so never going to be invited to participate in the White House administration, apparently. Alexander in Playa del Rey, California, welcome to the Mike Malloy program.
Hello there. Can you hear me okay?
I can. What's up?
I have a question. I'm a bit curious why these, and really progressive people. I'm talking people like Matt Taibbi, Noam Chomsky, Bill Maher.
Yeah.
Calls people who, he calls us conspiracy theory idiots.
Right.
I can't understand why they would call us idiots when we're asking a question about the facts on the ground.
Let me answer that question. Let me give you my thoughts on that, Alexander. There's a lot of bad guys out there who just don't want to answer the question, who prefer the quote-unquote official story, prefer that you're in fear, prefer that you never ask questions. Then there are other good guys, and I consider both Taibbi and Maher to be good guys, but the fact of the matter is, when you're harangued, when you're harassed, when you're, you know, called part of the conspiracy, hell, I've been called part, I'm, working for Rove, I don't, cover 9/11 enough, the backlash can be pretty severe as far as, it can put you off. So when you want to know these questions, I think you ask them politely. And if you don't get the answers, you can keep asking, but you need to get out there, dig yourself, investigate. I think there's a lot of blowback, which tends to be counterproductive to the mission at hand, to the questions at hand. So I think we all need to step back. We got to ask questions. I'm all in favor of it. But when you start getting out there and accusing people of, being crazy, covering up for CIA and Karl Rove, when there's evidence to the contrary, surely, with guys like Taibbi and Maher, then you got to ask questions. Does that make any sense, Alexander?
Yeah, it does. It does make some sense. Now, Noam Chomsky also said they were fanatics. I emailed him.
And they are fanatics, and there may be a reason to be a fanatic. And, Alexander, I got to get to
it. You mean like David Ray Griffin is a fanatic?
He may be a fanatic, yeah.
Yeah, okay, I can understand that. I mean, I think what happens is that David Ray Griffin tells us the facts on the ground, but then he jumps to the conclusion and says it's an inside job.
That's right.
And that part we don't have any evidence for.
I couldn't agree with you more, Alexander. Thanks for that call. All right, Brad Friedman in for Malloy. Your calls, and Rush Limbaugh, that small, pathetic little man, straight ahead.
Jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. They played it left hand, but made it too far.
Stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up. Stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Standing up for your rights here on the Mike Malloy program. Brad Friedman in for Mike. We're taking your calls at 877-520-1150. Agent 99 is manning the very lively chat room over there tonight at bradblog.com. Go to the top item. Hit click here for more, and you'll be in that chat room. Participate in the conversation if you want, if you can keep up with it. That item, by the way, is right above the one that talks about what Ray McGovern, the 27-year CIA veteran, had to say last night right here on this show. It was quite chilling, frankly, when he said this guy, and Ray McGovern, you know, gave presidential daily briefings directly to guys like George Bush Sr. And what he had to say, frankly, scared the hell out of me last night. He said that, he said, let me just leave you with this thought. And that is that I think Leon Panetta, director of the CIA, and to a degree President Obama are afraid. I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, he said. I think they're afraid of the CIA. He then went on to allude to the assassination of JFK. Which is written about in a new book by James Douglas. And he said that he thought both Panetta and the president were afraid of these guys because these guys have a whole lot to lose if justice takes its course, he said, in regard to the CIA torture investigation, which he points out have penalties such as capital punishment because some 100 or more detainees died in custody, said Ray McGovern, 27-year CIA veteran, says there is reason for Obama to be scared of the CIA. Don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me. But we are without fear and pressing ahead here, and we are going to get to more of your calls about 9/11 on the 9/11 anniversary. But first, I was listening to this small, little, pathetic man, this outrageous man today by the name of Rush Limbaugh. You may have heard of him because he is on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stations across your public airwaves. That stations, by the way, get for free. They lease them from the government, from you, so that Rush Limbaugh can make just unbelievable statements. We got a bunch of clips here. Obama was speaking today, commemorating 9/11. He declared it a national day of service, and Rush Limbaugh had to find something wrong with that, even on 9/11. Absolutely pathetic. Here's a quick clip.
Now, the manner in which President Obama has chosen to commemorate 9/11, the day the country was attacked, and our first retaliation was launched from onboard Flight 93, is an outrage. It is an insult to the memory of innocent Americans who were attacked and who died 8 years ago today. The manner in which Obama has chosen to commemorate 9/11 is an insult to the citizen warriors aboard Flight 93.
A day of service is an insult and an outrage to those who died on Flight 93. Sorry, Rush. Your days are over, pal. Your days of scaring this country are over, pal. Yeah, a day of service. Service to your nation. You familiar with that, sir? No, that's right. You're not. You chose not to serve. You got out of the draft because of a boil on your ass. Coward. Got clip number two, Tone.
Before I go further, I want you to hear how President Obama is commemorating 9/11. This could be the most outrageous moment yet of the Obama presidency, twisting 9/11 into a nationalist day of service to the state.
On this first national day of service and remembrance, we can summon once more that ordinary goodness of America to serve our communities, to strengthen our country, and to better our world. Let us renew our common purpose. Let us remember how we came together as one nation, as one people, as Americans, united not only in our grief, but in our resolve to stand with one another, to stand up for the country we all love.
This is an outrage to take this day and twist it into a nationalist day of service to the state and to our communities.
Uh-huh.
Is insulting.
Oh, is it, Rush?
It's insensitive.
Is it, Rush?
It is beyond the pale, but it's typical of who Obama is.
Yeah, who Obama is. A man who gives a damn about his country. Speaking of twisting, to twist the words. Now, the reason I'm playing you the clips, these are actually clips when you hear Obama here speaking. These are the clips that Rush Limbaugh has pulled out to show you how outrageous it is. The outrageous things that Barack Obama had to say. Things like, we should remember this day by serving in our communities. No, he did not say service to the state. Not, by the way, that there's anything wrong with service to the state. That does happen to be what folks in the military do. Folks in the CIA do. These folks that Rush Limbaugh has spent years telling us that he supports, when in truth, he doesn't give a rat's ass about anybody in the U.S. military, anybody in the CIA. This is about politics, plain and simple, from a small, pathetic man.
The president's call for community service demeans what happened on 9/11. It is a distraction from what was and is important. So I want to do two things.
Uh-huh.
To try to distract from the insulting, demeaning remarks of the President of the United States today, calling on us to all serve our state.
Oh, insulting.
And our community.
Oh, how
demeaning. I'm
going to
read
demeaning.
You the Gettysburg Address.
Demeaning.
And then I'm going to read you Todd Beamer's
address?
Story.
Todd Beamer's story? What the hell does that have to do with serving in our community? How twisted do you have to be to try to find something, anything to hate on Barack Obama? And believe me, there is plenty. We have spent the whole damn week criticizing Barack Obama, criticizing the way he's approached health care and the way he's approached accountability and torture investigations and everything else. But how twisted, how sick, how lost and lonely do you have to be to take these kind of twisted shots at a president of the United States on 9/11 asking for folks to stand up and serve their communities? Remember, when you hear Obama here speaking, these are the clips that Rush has pulled to demonstrate to you how outrageous and evil Barack Obama is.
Here's another portion of his remarks.
This may be the greatest lesson of this day, the strongest rebuke to those who attacked us, the highest tribute to those taken from us, that such sense of purpose need not be a fleeting moment. It can be a lasting virtue. For through their own lives and through you, the loved ones that they left behind, the men and women who lost their lives 8 years ago today leave a legacy that still shines brightly in the darkness. And it calls on all of us to be strong and firm and united. That is our calling today and in all the Septembers still to come.
Remember how he started these remarks. On this first National Day of Service and Remembrance, we can summon once more that ordinary goodness of America to serve our communities, to strengthen our country,
right,
and to better our world.
Oh, it sounds good to me.
A National Day of Service.
Good.
When brave Americans sacrifice their lives so the rest of us can live and live free, I don't think of a National Day of Service to the state.
Of course you don't. They gave their lives in service to the state, you jackass. How pathetic is this man? Now, we know he's pathetic, but he is allowed on the airwaves, on your public airwaves. Does anybody give a damn about that? Does anybody give a damn that he is on hundreds and hundreds of stations? Meanwhile, folks out there who are asking questions, trying to tell the truth, I'm one of them. I get to sit in for a few hours every now and again when Mike Malloy will have me. No, I don't have a show. But I'm glad to be here when Mike will have me. Mike is on a few dozen stations. Randy is out there. Tom is out there. Stephanie Miller is out there. If you can find them. Have trouble finding Rush Limbaugh? I don't think so. We drive all across this nation, and from town to town, we have to adjust the radio to find something to listen to as we're driving. Guess what? No problem finding Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck to twist and to turn and to hate and to take something like a 9/11 commemoration and turn it into, I don't know what the hell he was turning it into. The dude is sick. We know that. But what the hell is he doing on our airwaves criticizing statements like this?
On this first National Day of Service and Remembrance, we can summon once more that ordinary goodness of America to serve our communities, to strengthen our country, and to better our world. Let us renew our common purpose. Let us remember how we came together as one nation, as one people, as Americans, united not only in our grief, but in our resolve to stand with one another, to stand up for the country we all love.
Are you appalled? Because Rush Limbaugh was. That's what he played on his show today to tell us how terrible Barack Obama was. He then went on to say, let's go to 7 here, Tony. He then had to twist and turn to find something, anything, any reason, and he dragged in all kinds of things. Joe Wilson and Congressman Joe Wilson, the one who called him a liar the other night. Go ahead, play that clip.
And they today tell us that the hatred and vitriol resides now in the voice of a lone congressman from South Carolina, Joe Wilson.
He resides in you,
who
Rush.
Who simply could not stand being lied to by the President of the United States in a fraudulent, demeaning, disgusting address. He has now compounded the fraud, the disgust, and the indignity of his remarks on Wednesday night with the proclamation on the 8th anniversary of 9/11 that this is the first National Day of Service to the state. I'm simply appalled.
Appalled or appalling? Rush, you are appalling. Can you imagine if George Bush had given that exact same address on 9/11, had called for a National Day of Service, had the temerity, hang on, hold that for a second, had the temerity to ask people to stand together, to talk about the legacy that still shines brightly and calls on all of us to be strong, firm, and united. Rush would have sang his praises, would have called him the king of the world. Barack Obama dared to do the same thing, and these idiots, these anti-American haters, these terrorists of the airwaves, will twist, will turn, will try to do anything, anything they can, to tear down Barack Obama, to tear down the Democrats, to tear down so much of what these guys are trying to do to make things better. Whether they're succeeding or not, doesn't matter. Anything out there, they are against it. Here is the new National Republican Committee theme song.
I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
Turns out Rush Limbaugh is the real Marxist, apparently. Thanks, Groucho. At the Republican theme song. More right after this on The Molloy Show.
I'm against it.
Tony is the best damn engineer in radio. I just want to get that out right here and now. He's been with me all week long, and in case I'm not able to sing your praises sufficiently at the end of the show when I run up against the clock, let me say it now. You rock, dude. Tony Sorrentino. He rocks. So there you have it. In undeniable proof that Rush Limbaugh is, in fact, a Marxist. And if you're just joining us, of course, I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, sitting in for Mike Molloy on the Mike Molloy program. And if you don't know, if you didn't hear the absolute proof that Rush Limbaugh is a Marxist, it can no longer be denied, then you can check the podcast later at MikeMolloy.com or at BradBlog.com. We'll have it up tonight for you. All right. In the meantime, he's out there bitching and moaning about Barack Obama politicizing 9/11 somehow by asking for a day of service to your community. He thinks it's outrageous that they're politicizing. Well, guess what? Do I have time? Yeah. Okay. Glenn Beck tomorrow. Speaking of small, pathetic, sad men, this is the 9/12 project that Glenn Beck will be doing tomorrow that he invented. Tomorrow, right-wingers, protesters will gather in Washington, D.C. for a march to oppose health reform, President Obama, corruption, and an overall conversion to a socialist-style government. The event schedule was intentionally scheduled for September 12 to coincide with the anniversary of the day following the September 11 attacks, and it was conceived largely by Fox News' Glenn Beck. Beck, the McCarthyite Fox News talk show host, I concur, this is from Think Progress, by the way, who has lost dozens of advertisers for calling Obama a racist. Dozens. He's lost about 50 or 60. He is a relentless promoter of his 9/12 project. However, most of the day-to-day organizing has been orchestrated by a now familiar set of lobbyists and Republican operatives who have helped plan the anti-Obama grassroots Tea Party events since February. So they have been planning since February, since a month after Barack Obama was elected. They have been planning for all that time to be outraged and to use the anniversary of 9/11 to express their political outrage. By the way, in the past, Think Progress goes on, Beck has said that he hates, that's a quote, he hates the families of the victims of the September 11 terrorist attacks. In 2007, Beck criticized the supporters of the Ron Paul Revolution, who did a fundraiser on Guy Fawkes Day, saying, quote, "It's really not the way I would go, tying my movement in with a historical terrorist attack, especially in post-9/11 America." Did you get that? It's really not the way he would go, tying in a movement with a historical terrorist attack, especially in post-9/11 America. And yet, tomorrow, he'll be celebrating 9/11 with his 9/12 initiative. Have I mentioned lately that these are pathetic, small, sad human beings, and they shouldn't be on the airwaves? Actually, they can be on the airwaves. That's fine with me. But for every 3 hours of Rush, let's put 3 hours of Tom Hartman on right after him on every damn station. Fair enough? There's your fairness doctrine. No, we don't want to take you off the air, Rush. Glenn, Sean, we would just like to be fair and balanced. Ever heard of that? Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. Much more. Stick with us. Friedman in for just one more hour. In for Mike Malloy, who is out enjoying a week off. It's been a hell of a week around here. Really enjoyed sitting in. Hope you were able to put up with me. It was good to be here. Interesting week between 9/11 today, the 8th anniversary, the healthcare speech live coverage on Wednesday, Labor Day. Hell of a week. Broadcasting live from Los Angeles, where the sun has finally set. We're glad you're sticking with us out there on the East Coast. Our phone number is 877-520-1150. Interesting. Coming at 9/11 from a whole bunch of different angles tonight, and I'm going to get to shortly here one of the most disturbing costs, frankly, of 9/11. But I wanted to get the phone lines were filled up, and I had to rant on Rush Limbaugh, so I didn't get to get to those phones as I promised. Joe in Van Nuys, California. Welcome to the Malloy program, Joe.
Hi. Good last name, Friedman, like you freed men from the lies.
That's it, Joe. Thanks for noticing.
I got a couple of two-word things. One is double standard.
Yeah.
The other one is character assassination.
Yeah.
And the double standard, of course, you know that fairness doctrine thing back in the Reagan era,
Yeah. You
know, that went away.
Killed
you know?
By Ronald Reagan in 1987. Fairness doctrine is gone, and Bill Clinton made it worse in 1996 with the Telecommunications Act that allowed these empires of media to grow instead of
Ronald
the people's airwaves. Yeah.
I believe Ronald was probably the coincidental greatest character assassinator because all he had to do was wiggle his head a little bit, say, well, there you go again, and the intellects like Teddy Kennedy and Jimmy Carter, you know, their credibility and reputation, oh, they're the dummies now, all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It was just masterful. And then,
it is.
And
they
then
own
that
the media.
Fairness doctrine went,
yep.
And it was like evil had a litter of lying dogs.
Yep.
Like Rush and O'Reilly, you know, and later on Beck, I guess, was the second litter.
Yep.
But, oh.
I couldn't agree more, Joe. Well said. Thank you, sir. Good talking to you. All right, let me get to, Brian in Redondo Beach. Welcome to the Mike Malloy program, Brian.
Hi, Brad. How you doing tonight?
I'm okay.
You know, I'm sitting here listening to your show right now. And,
good.
And
perfect.
Awesome.
I'm sitting here doing it right now, as it turns out, my show right now. All right, go ahead.
You're going to get your own one day.
All right.
I promise.
Okay.
But Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all those guys, and I, you know, I heard the president say, I talk to everyone. If we bring in the leaders of the birthers, the healthers, the deathers, the teabaggers, talk to them, show them the unfinished bill that's not even complete yet, and teach them about government, that it has to go through committees. No one knows that. I mean, most people don't know. It's gone through 80 committees already.
Right.
So we're 80% done.
Yeah.
And the lies have to stop. And if he gets those people, teach them about government, let them walk through their White House, let them walk through the yard, and tell them that the government is not that scary. And I don't know, he doesn't want their guns. He can fix it easily. I think he can do it easily by just talking to those people.
Well, thanks for that call, Brian. The problem is, those people don't want to talk to him. They're not trying to make a better health care bill. They're not trying to work with him to get what they want. They want to kill the bill. They want to kill him politically, at least. You know, it is about destroying Barack Obama. It's about destroying Democrats. It's not about improving the bill. I've been critical as hell of this bill But not because I want to destroy Barack Obama, but because I think we need a better bill. We need health care in America. We need America to understand that health care is a human right. End of story. Period. Done. But if you're negotiating in bad faith, as these birthers, deathers, teabaggers, and other clowns are, then it doesn't matter if you talk to them, because they don't want to talk to you. And he has. He has over and over again tried to talk to them, invited them in. They have been part of the negotiations. They've, you know, gotten hundreds of their amendments in. They're strictly against it. You heard Groucho Marx sing it in the last hour. Now let's get to Peter in Philadelphia. Welcome to the Mike Malloy Show, Peter.
Michael, hi. I have a question.
Wait, Michael?
For you.
Who's Michael?
Oh, I'm sorry. Listen, I have a question for you.
All right. Brad, I'm Brad.
Michael was my kid. I was talking to my kid over here, Michael, who was looking at me.
Oh, okay.
I consider myself to be a centrist.
Okay.
All right, I'm not far left, I'm not far right.
Me too, by the way, Peter.
Great. The question that I really had was, with the Van Jones issue from last week, and I listened to Beck and I listened to Rush, did they play his quotes out of context? Were they not playing the full quotes that he was using? Because I was just hearing blurbs.
What did you hear? What quotes?
Well, when he was, there was one where he was talking about Bush with the oil, and he was making, sounds going, oh, drill more, drill more, drill more. Mm-hmm. And then there was the other one where...
Was that offensive? Were you offended by it?
Well, not that I was offended by it, but like I said, I'm a centrist because I know there's good and bad on both sides.
Yeah, and me too. So what's your point?
And I didn't know, because I really don't listen a lot to the left radio. I started listening to it in about the last week just to try to get a balance on both sides because I just got the satellite radio.
Where did you find the left radio?
On Sirius.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on Sirius Left. So I listened to the right, left and the right. I was trying to get an equal perspective on both.
Fair enough.
And I just wanted to get the left side of it, of what they thought about the Van Jones quotes that were being used.
Well, I will tell you this. He made some jokes, Van Jones did. He called Republicans a-holes, but what he was actually saying was that was a good thing, and that Barack Obama, he said, should be more of an a-hole, that I should be more of an a-hole, and that we might get more stuff done. Was there anything that you were offended by that you heard Van Jones say that deserved to lynch him?
No. You know what? It's politics. And
well,
that's just, it's the way it is. It's the left against the right and the right against the left. And that's when people
No, it's not. It's the right against America, and that's a big difference. You got to turn down your radio there, Peter. What are you thinking? Turn it down. Because I'm enjoying talking to you, but it's not the right against the left. It's the right against America. Because remember, he was critical, Beck was, of Van Jones for signing that statement asking questions about 9/11. But that was after he had spent the week in a special series of episodes subtitled Reasonable Questions for Unreasonable Times. And he told everyone that they should question with boldness and they should hold to the truth, and that even if the answers scare you, you must speak without fear. He quoted Thomas Jefferson saying, question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. And then what Glenn Beck did was throw Van Jones into the briar patch for daring to ask about 9/11, for daring to join with 50 family members of victims of 9/11 and asking for a proper investigation. It's outrageous, Peter. Surely you understand that.
Well, I said, I'm kind of a centrist. I'm listening to both, and I just like to get the opinions of both sides before I make a judgment.
Okay, just so you know, there is no left on the air. There is the right, the wacko right that you hear, and there is the center, folks like you and me. That's it.
And so, but there's no left?
No.
Okay.
Who's on the left?
What's that?
Who do you hear on the air who's on the left?
Well, who do I hear on the air that's on the left? Well, you sound pretty left because you're saying you're centrist, but you're saying that the right is that the right is horrible.
Well,
you're calling yourself a centrist.
Well, do you believe in the rule of law?
Yes, I do.
Do you believe in the Constitution?
Yes, I very much believe in the Constitution.
Okay. Well, don't you believe then that when people break the law, when people violate the Constitution, there should be accountability?
Yes,
is
on
that,
both sides.
I concur. Is that the position of someone on the left or right or the center?
That's the center. But as you're saying, there is no left. It's only right and right wackos and centers.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's
well,
correct.
Have a good night.
There is no left. Thank you, Peter. there is no left. You folks are stuck in the middle with me, and I'm glad to have you here. All right, we're taking your calls, 877-520-1150, 877-520-1150. Actually, let me go ahead momentarily here and take a break, because I want to come back with this decision. This should speak to Peter and the Constitution, and those of us who have real concerns about the Constitution, those of us right down the middle, right in the center, those of us who agree with the rest of America, with 70% of America who wants health care reform, you remember us here in the center. The left? I don't know where to find them. The liberal media? Where the hell are they? I wish they'd show up. I'd feel good about that, but I haven't seen them. So, anyway, it's just the truth tellers out here and the truth seekers out here battling the liars. That's a lot more accurate than this right, left, red, blue nonsense. Don't buy it. Don't buy it, Peter. Y'all can do better than that. 877-520-1150. Brad in from Alloy. Stay with us.
You're going to love this. Just love it.
This goes out to Peter in Philadelphia.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I do, to speak to
I
Peter.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
No fear here.
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Fear is for Limbaugh and friends.
To the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
That's right, Peter, I am stuck in the middle with you. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com in our final hour tonight here talking about just about everything, but what the hell happened since 9/11 and the fear, the lies. Folks, we got to put an end to it. We got to put an end to it. Enough fear. No living in fear. Got that? Well, at least not over at bradblog.com. Taking your calls at 877-520-1150. I'll read you a story in a second. Court decision talking about fear, talking about the way that we behave, the way that we misbehave, the way that we destroyed the Constitution and everything that this nation stands for out of fear. This case of Abdullah Al-Kid versus John Ashcroft, in which Ashcroft took a spanking by the Ninth Circuit Court. Three judges, all appointed by Republican presidents. Two of them happened to be George W. Bush appointees, as I recall. And they spanked him, took him down. For what? For locking away a citizen without charges. For no reason whatsoever. We'll talk about that after we come back at the bottom of the hour. We will take your calls, 877, until then, and beyond then, 877-520-1150. Tim in Glendale, welcome to the Mike Malloy program.
Thank you, Brad. I was just wondering, is that Van Jones, is he a centrist?
He is now. I mean, yeah, actually, if you read what he's done, what he's up to, yeah, I think he's a centrist. He had days when he was an angry revolutionary, I think, or at least he joked about being a revolutionary. But yeah, he's pretty much straight down the middle now, and he's been lauded from all sides, at least until he was named by Barack Obama. Why do you ask?
Well, as I understand it, he had a clear affiliation, or maybe still does, with the Communist Party. Is that BS, or is that...
That's BS. Yeah, that's BS.
He never had an affiliation with the Communist Party.
That's correct.
Well, then if that's the case, then Glenn Beck must be lying.
Bingo.
Well, I think I would be more curious to know if Barack Obama threw him on the bus, why yeah. would he, unless there was some other affiliation besides just this thing about,
yeah.
you know, what, reasoning that fired. How is that possible?
How is that possible? Because the right-wingers own the media, and 24-7, they hammer, they lie, they make things up. How is it possible that Bill Clinton could be impeached for getting a... sexual act in the White House, whereas George Bush lied an entire nation into war, thousands are dead, violated the Constitution by torturing thousands of people in secret prisons around the country, outing a CIA agent for the first time in the history of this nation, and he has gotten nothing, no impeachment, no slap on the wrist, no nothing, and you wonder why it is, how it is, that these cowardly Democrats, you know, bend over and to this sort of threat from the media that comes at them 24/7. Are you really asking me that question, Tim?
I would just be curious to know, and I will look it up. But
yeah.
but I would have to believe that Van Jones, from everything I've understood and read,
yeah.
he had a clear affiliation with the Communist Party. Now you say he doesn't. You say he doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But
yeah.
But there had to be more. If you're going to get fired from a job,
yeah.
I don't care how strong you think that the right wing media is.
Tim,
there must be a reason why more people must enjoy listening to that than they do the left wing.
Tim, more well for one, Tim, he was guilty of being a Democrat. Two.
I'll be guilty of being.
Look it up. Go look it up, but don't look it up on Glenn Beck's side.
Not being a Democrat.
Okay.
Not being a Democrat, Brad. You've got to be honest now.
No, I am honest now. He was guilty of being a Democrat, and actually, you're right. You're right. He was guilty of being a black Democrat, the worst of all crimes.
It's not a racial thing.
Think
you're
it over, Tim.
Up.
Think it over. I got to let you go. I'm going to the bottom of the hour here. The fact of the matter is, when you say that people don't hear it because it's not as popular, I've said this over and over again. Tom Hartman has said it over and over again. Stephanie Miller has said it over and over again. The fact of the matter is, in Stephanie's case, she's on about 60 stations. She beats Laura Ingraham's ass every town, every city, every market that they're in. But Laura Ingraham of Fox News is on hundreds of affiliates. They will only allow Stephanie on 60, despite the fact that when they're on head-to-head, who wins? Stephanie does. Now, is that because the Democrats are not popular enough? Is that because the liberals and the progressives don't make good radio? They're not entertaining? Think again. Bill Clinton allowed for just a handful of companies to own every damn radio station in the country, which means they control your public airwaves. Pay attention, folks. And turn off Fox News. They lie to you. They're playing you for chumps. Wake up, America. Back with more.
All of my life I have searched for clarity. I have wrestled with two paths buried deep inside of me. I lost some rounds, been knocked around, felt my share of defeat. Yet somehow I've always managed to get back on my feet.
Back on our feet. We were never off our feet. Here on the Mike Malloy Show, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, your friendly citizen, investigative journalist, blogger, troublemaker, muckraker. Drafted into duty, be in the media here until Mike and Kathy Malloy return next Monday night. Mark it on your calendars. The one and only Mike Malloy will be back. I'll finish up with your calls in a second, but I wanted to give 877-520-1150. But I want to give you a quick idea of some of the cost that we paid other than in the death toll in the thousands and thousands that have happened since 9/11. Because of just some terribly poor decisions. And that death toll continues to rise, whether it's the first responders, whether it's the folks who are still out there stuck in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Shamefully so. another cost is in the legal system and in the Constitution that has been destroyed. Attention, teabaggers. For the last 8 years, your administration, who you voted for, has been destroying your Constitution. This is a decision that I've been trying to get to all week long. I want to try to get it in here. Ibrahim al-Kid, Abdullah al-Kid versus John Ashcroft. And here are the, I want to give you the facts and procedural background on what happened with al-Kid, because the decision was stern, was clear, and by the three judges on the Ninth Circuit Court who slammed Ashcroft and George Bush for what they did to this guy, and those three judges were all appointed by Republican presidents. Okay, here's the facts and procedural background. I'll try to read quickly. Pay attention. Plaintiff appellee al-Kid was born Lavoni T. Kid in Wichita, Kansas, while attending college at the University of Idaho, where he was a highly regarded running back on the university's football team. He converted to Islam and changed his name. In the spring and summer of 2002, he and his then wife were the target of a FBI Federal Bureau of Investigation surveillance as part of a broad anti-terrorism investigation allegedly aimed at Arab and Muslim men. No evidence of criminal activity by al-Kid was ever discovered. Al-Kid had planned to fly to Saudi Arabia in the spring of 2003 to study Arabic and Islamic law on a scholarship at a Saudi university. On February 13, 2003, a federal grand jury in Ohio indicted Samir Omar al-Hussein for visa fraud and making false statements to U.S. officials. On March 14, the Idaho U.S. Attorney's Office submitted an application to a magistrate judge of the District of Idaho seeking al-Kid's arrest as a material witness in the al-Hussein trial. Appended to the application was an affidavit by Scott Mace, special agent of the FBI in Boise. The Mace affidavit described two contacts al-Kid had with al-Hussein. Al-Kid had received, quote, in excess of $20,000 from al-Hussein. I hope I'm saying that right. Al-Hussein, something like that. Though the Mace affidavit does not indicate what this payment was supposedly for. And al-Kid had, quote, met with al-Hussein associates after returning from a trip to Yemen. It also contained evidence of al-Kid's contacts with officials of the Islamic Assembly of North America, including one official who was, quote, recently arrested in New York. It ended with the statement, quote, due to al-Kid's demonstrated involvement with the defendant, he is believed to be in possession of information germane to this matter, which will be crucial to the prosecution, unquote. The Mace affidavit did not elaborate on what, quote, information that al-Kid might have had, nor how his testimony might be, quote, germane, let alone, quote, crucial to the prosecution of al-Hussein. The affidavit further stated, by the way, I'm reading from the court's decision. This is the court. These are the judges, the Republican-appointed judges who found in this case. The affidavit further stated the kid is scheduled to take a one-way first-class flight costing approximately $5,000 to Saudi Arabia on Sunday, March 16, 2003, at approximately 6 o'clock Eastern Time. He's scheduled to fly from Dulles International Airport to JFK International Airport in New York and then to Saudi Arabia. It is believed that if al-Kid travels to Saudi Arabia, the U.S. government will be unable to secure his presence at the trial via subpoena. Well, in fact, the court decision goes on to say, al-Kid had a round-trip ticket, a coach-class ticket, costing approximately $1,700. Not $5,000, not one way, not first class. The Mace affidavit omitted the facts that al-Kid was a U.S. resident and citizen, was not mentioned in the affidavit, that his parents, wife, and two children were likewise U.S. residents and citizens, and that he had previously cooperated with the FBI on several occasions when FBI agents asked to interview him. The magistrate judge issued the warrant, nonetheless, the very same day. Pursuant to the material witness warrant, Al-Kid was arrested 2 days later at the ticket counter at Dulles International Airport. He was handcuffed, taken to the airport's police substation, where he was interrogated. Thereafter, he was detained for an aggregate of 16 days at the Alexandria Detention Center in Virginia, the Oklahoma Federal Transfer Center, and the Ada County, Idaho Jail. Remember, he hasn't done anything. I'll keep reading. He was strip searched on multiple occasions, confined in the high security unit of each facility. During transfer between facilities, Al-Kid was handcuffed, shackled about the wrists, legs, and waist, allowed out of his cell only 2 hours each day, and his cell was kept lit 24 hours a day, unlike other cells in the high security wing. Remember, he was arrested as a material witness. He was not even accused of anything. He was arrested so that he could be called as a witness at someone else's trial. 16 days in one detention center after another, with his cell kept lit 24 hours a day. On March 31, after petitioning the court, Al-Kid was ordered released on the condition that he live with his wife at his in-law's home in Nevada, limit his travel to Nevada and three other states, report regularly to a probation officer, and consent to home visits throughout the period of supervision, and surrender his passport. After almost a year under these conditions, the court permitted Al-Kid to secure his own residence in Las Vegas, Nevada, as Al-Kid and his wife were separating because of the duress, no doubt, brought on by this case. He lived under these conditions for 3 more months before being released at the end of Al-Husayn's trial, more than 15 months after being arrested. Remember, he's done nothing, and he's a citizen, and nobody bothered to tell the judge. Going back to the court papers here. In July 2004, Al-Kid was then fired from his job. He alleges he was terminated when he was denied a security clearance because of the arrest. He's now separated from his wife and has been unable to find steady employment. He was also, ultimately, deprived of his chance to study in Saudi Arabia on scholarship. Here's the kicker. Al-Kid, according to the court documents, was never called as a witness in the Al-Husayn trial or in any other criminal proceedings. Imagine if Barack Obama had done that to a U.S. citizen. Let's say he was, Christian, and he was detained for never having done anything for months on end. He lost everything. Who would be angry about that, you suppose? Fox News, would they be talking about this story? Would they be reporting it? Would Rush Limbaugh be reporting it? You probably haven't heard about this story. The judges, of course, decided that, yes, he could be sued. John Ashcroft could be sued for this. The judges also wrote in the decision that they found what happened to be repugnant to the Constitution and a painful reminder of some of the most ignominious chapters of our national history. Hey, teabaggers, that was your administration. That's what they did. Now, by the way, Barack Obama is doing the same thing. He's detaining people without charges, preventative detention, they call it, and he's keeping them imprisoned for months, if not years, on end without charges. You want to stand up against your country, against your Constitution being shredded by your country? Where the hell were you teabaggers for the last 8 years? I've been waiting to hear from you. You haven't showed up. Michael from Hollywood, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
Hey, how's it going, Brad? Long time no talk. I called about something else, but Ashcroft has done a lot more things than that, and the amount of people that were detained were between 300 and 600 that were under the same circumstances. But I called about something else. The guy that called a little while ago having trouble discerning left from right.
Yeah.
I use an example to explain it very well, and everybody understands it once I finish.
Go for it.
If you've ever played tug of war, you got that long rope, you got that line in the sand, and you got the red flag.
Right.
down to the left, the Democrats to the right, the Republicans, for the last 40 years, the Republicans have been tugging and tugging and tugging and tugging and tugging, and that red flag has moved and moved and moved and moved and moved, and now that we got someone centrist, in fact, I consider Barack Obama a little bit right, in office, they're pointing to the red flag and they're saying that's the center.
I know, of course.
And it's not. It's the sand. It's the line in the sand.
Of course, you're absolutely right, Michael. Thanks for the call. There is no left. I think it was Bill Maher who said that the left is it has not moved to the right, and the right has moved to the insane asylum. That's about right. There is no left anymore. Have you taken a look at Barack Obama's policies? Good Lord. The left, the progressive position for health care, that would be single payer. It's not even on the table. All right. I'm going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back and try to get as many of your calls in as we possibly can in our last segment here on the Mike Malloy Show. What a week! I've had a good time. Hope you've had half as good a time as I have. All right, Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. One more segment, your last chance, 877-520-1150. If you can get into those phone lines, we're going to fly through them quickly. So get your points together, get them right, and be ready right after this. Filling in for our last few minutes here for the good Mike Malloy, who will return on Monday. Set your clocks, pencil it into your calendars. The one and only Mike Malloy will be back next Monday on these fine radio stations. I'm going to fly through the phones in just a second here, but make sure I get everybody in. I want to thank Tony Sorrentino for a hell of a great week. I said it before, you're the best engineer in show business. Really, thank you, man. Really appreciate it, Tony. Producer Desi Doyen has been kicking ass on the phones, or as Stephanie says in this very chair, phones and drums. Thank you, Des, for producing all week. Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org for our archives and podcasts. Agent 99 has been holding down the fort in our new chat room at BradBlog.com. Smartly done, Niners. Want to thank K-Talk AM 1150 out here in L.A. for hosting me. Yes, your progressive talk station in Los Angeles. And, of course, Mike and Kathy Malloy for allowing me to fill in for you both while you've been gone. Hope you had a great vacation, and I'll be back anytime you need me. Of course, until then, I'll be over there on the Brad blog where you can find me, and I hope you will. For those listening tonight on MikeMalloy.com, make sure to stay tuned for Head On with Bob Kincaid. All right, let me fly through these calls as quickly as I can. Oh, my old friend Tom from Riverside, California. Hey, Tom Corbett. How are you, my friend?
Hey, doing great, Brad. How you doing, brother?
I'm hanging in there. Good to hear from you. You, even though you're my buddy, you only get about 20 seconds like everyone else.
Okay, are you ready?
Go.
Okay. Tower 7 dropped 4 hours later on its own during 9/11. The plane into the Pentagon never released any video for the most heavily protected building in the world.
Uh-huh.
Is there any list of passengers for the plane that went into the Pentagon? The hole in the Pentagon is smaller than the plane, and no plane parts were found on the ground. And to continue their ability to cover up everything, e-voting machine company ESNS has now taken over Diebold, and now a private company will count 75% of all the votes cast in the U.S. In secret. They will count them in secret.
Smartly done. If you want to be outraged, thanks, Tom, for that call. Good hearing from you. Hope you're well. If you want to be outraged about something, be outraged the fact that 120 million votes will be counted by one company in secret, a company by the name of ESNS, who has failed, lied, cheated time and time again in one election after another in your corporatized, privatized, public elections. Jen in Houston, welcome to the Molloy Show. You get your 20 seconds. What's up, Jen?
Hi. The thing that convinced me the most about 9/11 being a government conspiracy is David Shippers, the lead prosecutor against Clinton in the impeachment trials, is represented 12 FBI agents who were gagged because they tried to stop the attacks, but they were thwarted. There was an article about it in the Washington Post.
Okay.
And
I'm not familiar with it, but I believe you. I know that some of them testified that Sybil Edmonds brought in Bashir. Oh, shoot, I don't have his name, but the Iranian FBI translator who said that they had warnings going back as far as April of 2001. Anything else quickly, Jen? I got to go.
Okay.
Well done. Using your airwaves. They do belong to you. Okay, let me see who I can get in here. Dave in Montana, welcome to the show. You got 20 seconds. What's up?
Thank you. 2 points real quick. I think it's funny in the land of the free and the home of the brave, a tactic used against cowards, terrorism works. It's to destroy our Constitution.
Yep.
And that means that the Democrats and Republicans are a bunch of cowards. Second, the medical thing. To fix a problem created by insurance, with insurance, makes me think of the competence of these guys. And to fine us for not having this insurance is fascist of them. And then to tax us on the medical bills that we get is really crazy. And then I thought we own the insurance companies now.
Well,
we bought them out.
No. we didn't. We just gave them a whole bunch of your money. Okay, can I fit in one more here? Yes. Let's see. Oh, man. Let's see. Steven has been holding forever. Quickly, Steven, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
You bet.
Broadcasts have been awesome.
Thank you, sir.
The scientific evidence alone calls for an independent international investigation due to the cost we had. The truth is the integrity we need, not people who invalidate it. 9/11 Mysteries is the best documentary I've seen. It goes into the science of demolitions. I highly recommend people watch it.
Good.
Thank you for an awesome job, Brad.
Thank you, brother.
Awesome.
I appreciate it, Stephen. Thanks for holding so long.
All right.
And for using your airwaves. Use them or lose them. That's what I always say. And yeah, unfortunately, we lost them. Let's take them back. What do you say? Hey, by the way, I forgot to thank the truth seekers over at DU. Yes, Barbs, I caught you there in the Brad Blog chat room. You're welcome. Thank you for being so supportive. It has been a tremendous week, an exhausting week. I'm tired, but I got a lot of back stuff now that I got to catch up on over at the Brad Blog. I hope you will join me there at bradblog.com. Because there's a whole hell of a lot of stuff to come, at least until someone is silly enough to give me a microphone again. I've enjoyed being with you. Thanks for having me. Spread the good word. Keep it lit, America. We'll see you soon.